Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002. And we go out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Gaza, the horrors from the Middle East, but as not heard on the BBC. Plus our weekly news and disability update with Jason Yannakopoulos. And the history of warmongering with Webster Tarpley. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. And since we're talking about the Middle East, let's start with some Middle Eastern music.
Father's father planted here in this now broken earth an olive tree, and as a child I sang to it my secrets, and as I grew I felt part of me.
Its branches gave me shelter from the sun, its grey green leaves shaded my young dream. The fruit it bore was like a gift of hope. Of all the olive trees, I love this one.
The settlers came, they beat us black and blue. They said, next time we shoot you, understand. But still we dared to come, we had no choice. We came at night like thieves to our own land. Like ghosts we came, men, women, young and old, to pick the crop as we have always done. For centuries we harvested in peace. The oil we pressed was sweet, precious as gold. Now look, this is a cemetery for dreams. Their great machines crushed hope into despair. They ripped the heart from every living tree, except for one by three they chose to spare. They dug it up, they smuggled it away. This ancient tree, they saw it as a prize, for some Israeli rich enough to pay. $5,000 worth, that's what they say. Ghosts, last night I dreamed my father's father's father came to me. He took my hand and held it in his own and said, take heart, here is my olive tree.
And when I woke it was a kind of birth, and in my hand I found an olive stone. And in the field where once my tree had been, a thousand shapes arose out of the earth. I saw their faces, women, children, men, and each hand held a perfect olive stone, and each heart held a vision of to come. when all our olive trees will rise again.
And that there was Leon Russellson with the Song of the Olive Tree. And that is actually from a Fuse Records compilation, which came out in 2012, called Celebrating Subversion, the Anti-Capitalist Roadshow. And if you're interested in that, it's quite an interesting compilation, actually. The catalogue number's CFCD099. That's CFCD099. And maybe to help understand what the song's about, I'm joined by Rita Kangalusi and by Eddie James, both from the Bristol Palestine Embassy in Broad Street. Used to be called the Art Bar. Now, I think it's, particularly with what's going on in the Middle East, it's more that. Anyway, Rita, can you just tell us a little bit about the what that song means to you and what the importance of olives in that part of the world?
Hi. Basically, there's lots of farmers which, because of the type of geographic region, they produce lots of olives and olive oil, so they got lots of olive trees. And all Mediterranean is quite rich of olive trees everywhere. And it's an important part of their culture because they do lots of different things with the olives and the recipe, the way they cook, and bread and olives, like olive oil is something they eat in the morning.
It's lovely,
with the tartar,
isn't it?
Yeah. So they put olive oils everywhere. They cook with it. They make creams, and the soap is made with 75% of olive oil, and it's a fantastic soap and make your skin really, really soft. Some people even wash their hair with it.
And so these trees take a long time to grow, don't they?
Oh, they do. They, before they start to have any olives, they take at least 10 years, and they start to have a few olives, and then some of the olive trees are old as 3,000 years, I think. So they have a long, long life as well. So seeing Israeli uproot lots of olive trees in Palestine, it's really sad.
Well, that's right. They say, the Israelis say, though, that they need to take the trees down in order to increase their line of sight, the Israeli Defence Force soldiers, so that they can see if there are terrorists hiding.
Basically, all these olive trees belong to families which they have from many, many years, you know, their parents, grandparents. And when they take the olives, the family is already, like, down because they won't have an income. So they grab the land and they kick it out of the house. They demolish the house. Maybe they got notice a week before. And then bulldozer come, take the house down. So the Israeli grab more land, and then they will set up illegal settlement. They start to build their own houses, look like south of Spain, very beautiful. They got all these houses, all paint the house look all perfect, and they got swimming pools, lots of water. They waste so much water. And the Palestinians, they struggle because they lost their house, they lost the trees, they lost everything, and they haven't got anywhere to go.
Can't they plant other crops in the ground?
They can plant other crops, but then the Israeli, they uproot again. Only in 2009, they uproot 14,000 olive trees. 14,000.
Okay, so anyway, so this is all being brought into relief, really, by the recent outrages, I suppose, lots and lots of civilian deaths. I think we're running around about 1,800 now in Gaza. Eddie, do you want to just say something about your feelings about that? Because I know that you helped organise an occupation of the BBC, and I want to hear why.
Well, of course, if one goes back, you know, in yesteryear, the people of Gaza basically are the refugees from Greater Palestine, which was annexed by the emerging Israeli state.
Hang on, when you say annexed, what do you mean? We keep hearing about this. I mean, Hitler was doing annexing. Apparently Putin is doing annexing, but what does it mean?
Well, basically it means containing a people, so they have no longer access to their land. It means that you can, as is the case now, you can visit you know, kind of punishment on them, collective punishment, where everybody suffers whatever misdemeanor Israel say they've committed. So you have a situation where annexing is really the death of a nation, really.
Because, I mean, when Britain initially set up Palestine and Israel, I mean, it wasn't really set up by us. It was more the Israeli terrorists, or they weren't Israelis at the time, the Jewish terrorists at the time, the Irgun, fighting the British, who were, we had the British mandate there. But then there was a settlement, and there were certain places where the Israelis were going to be in the Israeli state, and then there was a completely different state called Palestine. I think it was the Six-Day War in the mid-1970s, where Israel was up, well, certainly they were fighting the Egyptians, but they also took over all that, and that's why we get this term, the occupied territories.
Well, I think as far as the Palestinians are concerned, because they never entered any agreement with either United Nations or the British, or the emergent, you know, Jewish fighters, they never had any agreement. So as far as they're concerned, Palestine still exists.
So we hear a lot, don't we, about the Jewish right to return, the right to return to Israel. But we don't. Maybe we're going to hear in the next few years about the Palestinian right to return.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, that's a curious statement. I mean, on that basis, the Romans could return to Britain. I mean, this is kind of biblical talk, which has nothing to do, you know, with the, you know, the ancient, you know, Palestinians.
What about the Israeli claim, though? I mean, the Israelis do claim, don't they, that God gave them this land?
Well, the problem for that is that the Canaanites, which the Palestinians and the Jewish would have originated from, occupied the land before the birth of Christ. So, you know, we're going back 5,000-6,000 years. So basically, they are the originators of the land, or the original occupants of the land. So
one thing that does strike me is that most of the Israelis do look like us, don't they? They kind of look like white Europeans, and I don't quite understand how they can have a right to return to somewhere which is actually naturally a quite dark-skinned part of the world.
Well, I mean, the only, if you do on a biblical basis, the only right of return would be for the Semites, which, you know, the Palestinians are. Obviously, the new emergent Israelis from 1948 would be European, so they would not be of that original stock. And I think some DNA was carried out, and some 70% of Israelis are not Semitic anyway. So it's really just, you know, a ludicrous situation.
Okay, well, anyway, why the BBC? Why did you decide the BBC would be, you wanted to sit outside there?
Well, the BBC, from as long as I've been watching them or listening to them, have actually always towed a kind of like, not a middle road, but more extreme road towards Israel. So what I've realised is that most of the, you know, discussion around, you know, the conflict is from an Israeli's perspective.
Well, one of the things that happens quite often is you'll get the Israeli line at the top of a news bulletin, for example, saying that the Israelis are saying this, that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, there's a competition there, isn't there, between the Palestinians and the Israelis as to sort of grab the initiative, grab the agenda.
I would disagree that it's competition. I think what you have here is a kind of an occupied people, you know, hopelessly undernourished, under occupation, and unable to kind of like match the power that the Israeli state can muster. So it's not so much a competition. I think if there is a term, terrorist, I think it would be a wrong term when you apply that to Palestinians. What I would call it would be resistance.
Well, the UN Charter does guarantee people the right of self-defence, doesn't it? It's absolutely cast iron in there. If you're under attack, you have the right to defend yourself.
Absolutely. And just remember, the Palestinians in Gaza that have been ruthlessly attacked are basically, you know, the landowners of everything outside of Gaza as well. So that hasn't been resolved.
I mean, anyway, also outside the BBC, big Palestinian flag and all this kind of thing. How many days were you there for, Rita?
We were there for about 13 days.
And just give us an idea of the sort of reaction of the public walking past in the street.
Fantastic. We got lots of signature. We put a letter to the BBC and people read it and just sign. And without even asking, people say, well done.
You've got your signatures there. You brought them with you.
I brought my signature with me. Have here 32 pages. I may get some more because
that looks
I don't
like
know.
A petition that might be on its way somewhere.
Yeah, it's about size, about 30. 20 to 30 signatures. And this is a complaint. It's a sign open letter to the BBC and about reporting about Gaza.
Okay, so what's the nub of your problem with the BBC then? What do you think they haven't done, and what have people signed up to there?
They signed up to the buyers. They're not reporting actually what happened, because they're always reporting Hamas as a terrorist group. Hamas is a democratic elected party. It's not a terrorist group. You like it or not, they decide to have that group, that political group. So what they have a homemade rocket, and they don't have an army, they don't have a navy, they don't have an air force.
Why do the Palestinians fire these rockets? Because surely all it does is it gives a propaganda gift to the Israelis. Because they're not really that effective, are they?
No,
it's almost
not
like a November the 5th rockets or something like that.
Yeah, like Christmas rockets, yeah. The one you use for New Year, basically.
Actually, I think they're probably more deadly than that. But that's the way that it comes across.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically... Gaza been in a siege for many years, okay? So they have... imagine you have your house. I build a wall around your house. And then I cut your electricity. I cut your water. I cut your medical supply. I cut the food. I make you your life really, really miserable. And then I may have something to defend myself. I have to do some holes in it on a soya. Try to get some fuel from Israel. A very high price, because Israeli knew about that. So they make actually businesses, commercial things. They sell the fuel 10 times more expensive than to the Israeli.
Well, they got a bit of a captive captive audience. I hate to say it, but it is a bit like a giant concentration camp.
It is a concentration. It's a prison. It's an open prison, and they can drop bombs anytime, because lots of people died. It's been reported, but they have 16, and the drones fly over Gaza every single day.
And this may be the first time you've ever seen a war conducted really effectively by these drones. These drones are there doing targeting, aren't they? It must be hideous to be there and
Tony,
hear these unmanned vehicles going overhead, spying on you, finding your children, and then being killed.
Yeah, Tony, you know, I got this live streaming on Gaza in three different Ustream, which I open sometime at night time, and I can hear the drones, and I seen the bomb dropping, and they go random. I was Skype with one of my friends, Yasir, and he's in 1 hour I hear 5 bombs dropping. This is a very beginning, about 3 days after.
Because these drones have been being developed by the United States, Britain, and Israel.
Yes.
What's happening effectively is a whole new type of what. This is the arms race, the modern arms race,
yeah,
coming into people's
man.
Homes,
they
flying over people's
man.
Homes.
They don't need any men. So there is no chance them to lose men.
And in the old days, of course, they had this thing called rendition, where soldiers had to grab people, stick them in airplanes, and move them around. Now they don't. They just kill them with drones. Now this is a massive increase in the arms race, but we don't see the Chinese and the Russians and other big power blocks pushing this. We only see Britain, the United States, and Israel really pushing this technology. Anyway, just tell us what happened at court, because you've been evicted this week as well, haven't you? I mean, it's kind of bound to happen. But who from the BBC? Any of the faces that we would know, or people we've heard?
Oh yes, what's his name? Tim Pemberton.
Okay, Tim Pemberton. He's the managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, and. You don't actually hear him on the radio. I don't know why, but you hear him on my show. I interviewed him on my Friday show. I do hear the politics programme on BCFM a couple of years ago. And I was asking him, why, just as the austerity is kicking in, why have you stopped this brilliant thing you used to do called Sorted, which was every week, anyone that had problems with big companies, electricity companies, that sort of thing, they used to have somebody on Radio Bristol who would help them sort their problem out and phone up the company, get them on the line, and then he scrapped it. So I wonder, you know, what's going on with him. But anyway, so he's in court and he's got his bit of land back now. He's yes. got his little bit of grass.
Yes. It's so sad. They just, you know, what about a little bit of grass without thinking about the big picture of all these children being murdered. And they don't recognize that as a human beings, basically. So the court went for hours. And at the end, we explained why we were there, but the judge only cared about the legal facts.
It took them a few days to get their legal papers together, didn't it? So they must have tried very hard and spent lots of our nice license fee payers money but anyway, so
for
good
cause.
So
anyway,
it's not there anymore, but you had a great time while you were there. You also got lots and lots of support, so maybe that's the best thing that's come out.
I think 95% or maybe 97% of people passed by. They were congratulating us, they were asking for support, they helped us on leafletting, and they took a leaflet with them and distribute in other areas. So we had a new group of people now involved on the pro-Palestinian cause and a human rights cause, basically.
And I was in BBC Radio Bristol, actually in the TV bit of it, in the production offices right inside the building last week. And I chatted to a few people about all this, and they were saying, well, actually, we support the people outside. So there's lots of staff inside there. It's really just the managers are kind of isolated. I mean, some of the staff are kind of like drones, and they'll just do what they're told, of course. But many of them have got minds of their own. So quite a lot of the staff have signed, I see, your petition.
Exactly. They signed a petition against the BBC, and they are staff.
So in a way, you've had an interesting effect on sorting the sheep from the goats at the BBC. So yes. Well done. Well done, Rita. Anyway, the other thing is I wanted to mention was that we had on this show last week, we had an interview with Gerald Kaufman, who he was the former Labour shadow foreign secretary, who was himself Jewish, and whose whole family were wiped out by the Nazis in Poland in the Second World War. His own mother was shot dead in her bed by a Nazi soldier. And he was saying how grandmother, did not die to provide cover for the Israelis to kill Palestinian grandmothers. He's Jewish himself, obviously. And the BBC pulled that from our weekly Best of BCFM. Some people on the station here decided that that was such an interesting interview, they would put it out to the BBC as the best, one of the best interviews for the week on BCFM. But Kirsty, I think it is, at the BBC, just said, oh no, we can't play that because it's not balanced. Yes. Well, I'm going to be actually writing to Gerald Kaufman just to let him know to see if he would like himself to speak to the BBC about why his testimony as someone whose entire family was wiped out by the Nazis and who is himself Jewish is not going to be heard on the BBC. There's also Max Kaiser. He's the guy on Rush Today that does a show with Stacey Herbert about the economy. He says, and he testified this on his programme, that the BBC, when he was doing a programme for them, said, you cannot talk about Israel under any context, which is the only editorial direction they were given. Now, doesn't that tell you something a bit strange about the BBC?
Yeah.
What's
very
going on?
Much what's going on. Plus, it's not true. It's not. It's basically, when they attack those, the Israeli attack the flotilla, the Freedom Flotilla, on
the Mavi Mara. This is a few years ago, yeah. A
few years ago, and that's 4 years ago now, and they attacked them in international water. The month later, the BBC program Panorama made this program called Dead in the Med. And after that, I lost completely trust on BBC because that was really unbalanced, biased 100%.
Well, I guess you'd call it propaganda, wouldn't you? Anyway, we're going to be talking a bit more about Gaza after we've heard some more music, this time chosen by Eddie.
Okay.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky. It's Good News Week. Someone's found a way to give the rotting dead a will to live, go on and never die. Have you heard the news? What did it say? Who's won that race? What's the weather like today? It's Good News Week. Lots of blood in Asia now, they butchered off the sacred cow, they've got a lot to eat. It's Good News Week. Doctors finding many ways of wrapping brains and metal trays to keep us from the heat. Contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky. It's Good News Week. Someone's found a way to give the rotting dead a will to live, go on and never die. Have you heard the news?
What did it say? Who's won that race? What's the weather like today?
What's the weather like today?
It's Good News Week. Lots of blood and Asia now. They butchered up the sacred cow. They got a lot to eat. It's Good News Week. Doctors finding many ways of wrapping brains and metal trays to keep us from the heat. To keep us from the heat. To keep us from the heat.
Hedge Hoppers Anonymous, if you can believe that. That is actually the name, supposedly, of the band there. And it's called a song called Good News Week, I would guess, sometime during the 70s. And this is from a record. No, not a record. A CD. And it's called Songs of Protest. And it's the sort of thing we're not really hearing enough of nowadays, I think. And that is Songs of Protest, various artists. Catalogue, it's on Rhino. Catalogue number R2. 70734. That's R2 70734 on Rhino. Okay, now back to you, Eddie. You chose that song. Why did you choose it?
Well, I think it's a song that sums up. I mean, in 1970, come on, look where we are now. Bombing is the name of the game. You know, bombing indiscriminately is the name of the game. So there's a song 30, 40 years ago that could be sung today and it would be totally appropriate, probably more so than it was in the 70s.
And one of the things to do with the bombs, of course, is you've been checking on how much in the way of arms. We all hear about the wonders of technology in the arms industry and how it's good it is for Britain's economy. But how much has been going to the Israelis?
Well, the £7.8 billion worth, I'm told. I mean, this is information from Google, so it might not be 100% correct, but around £7.8 billion worth of arms were sold to Israel. Now,
the problem, over a long period, is that?
It's a new deal, I think. And what we're finding is that some of the, and perhaps some of it's
maybe
an
David
old deal.
Cameron helped cut that deal when he was, because he did a tour, didn't he, a couple of years ago, right around the Middle East, trying to sell British weapons.
Well, that's right. And is it a question that these weapons, some of them are, there, some of the weapons that were licensed. And some weren't. The ones that weren't were ones capable of being fired from the Israeli Navy. The Israeli Navy has been bombarding Gaza with these weapons. The question that we need to ask Cameron, are these some of the weapons that were not to be licensed to Israel, but they somehow found their way there? And what about the ones they did license? How many of them are now being bombed and killing, you know, innocent women and children?
So I suppose in the background, I'm thinking every time I hear, oh, yes, the arms industry is very good for Britain. It's a growth industry. It's doing very well on the stock exchange. I'm only thinking in the background of my mind, well, whereabouts are those arms being used?
Well, that's right. I mean, in particular, you could say the drone industry. I mean, Britain has bought nearly £1 billion worth of drones from Israel. Battle-tested, Israel claim. On whom? Gaza? Because if this is the case, you can see why Cameron can't be critical of Israel, because they're good customers. They're doing business with them. And obviously, if it's the sort of business that's killing women and children, that wouldn't want
well,
to be...
whatever happened to our ethical foreign policy? Rita, what about this? I mean, we hear about this as the Holy Land. It doesn't seem. It seems like now it's the unholy land.
The unholy land, yeah. I think all this, they say if there is no war, they're not going to make any money. So they need to keep going with the war on one side, on another side of the planet. There's always some war going on. Also, when they produce this weapon, they have to use it because it costs more money to decommission them than use it. So why don't use it then?
That's awful, isn't it? The idea that you've got big stocks of weapons and you've got loads of generals just itching to use them one way or another.
Yeah.
Also, one of the other possibilities for the reason why the Israelis are getting a bit frustrated and there's a fascinating article this week on something called Press TV, which is the Iranian English language website and broadcasting channel. 9/11 probe closes in on Israel. That's the headline. Why is Israel committing suicide is the subtext. But what this author of this article does is go through lots of reasons why the Israelis are actually linked to the 9/11 attacks. I mean, there's quite a lot here, but I mean, I'll just pick on one. Apparently, there were three Israelis were arrested in New York on 9/11 with a truckload of explosives in an apparent effort to blow up the George Washington Bridge. There were also three Israelis who were dancing and shouting on 9/11 itself, filming the attack on the World Trade Center. Now, how did they know it was about to happen? It was supposed to be a surprise attack. So there are, it seems, some links. Maybe the Israelis just knew that it was happening. They didn't tell the Americans.
I think that's highly probable. I mean, look at the history of Israel and America. I mean, though Americans support them blindly, the USS Liberty, that was a boat that was tried to be taken out by Israel.
Oh, that's right. And interestingly enough, the admiral in charge of that boat was a guy called Admiral George Morrison in the Eastern Mediterranean, the father of the lead singer of The Doors, George Morrison, Jim Morrison. George was his father. He was in charge, and he ordered a strike on Israel.
That's right, and that, I believe, was recalled by the new president, Lyndon Johnson, said we don't want to embarrass our allies. So
back to 9/11.
Back to 9/11.
I would like to add something there.
I would honestly say that I doubt if Israel actually, you know, pulled the trigger, so to speak, but they certainly knew about it. I think there were some interesting absences in the trade tower on the actual strike time as well. I'm not sure about that, but they said it was some people must have, you know, conveniently made an appointment or didn't turn up there. Quite a lot of that. And these are possible people that might have been connected or would certainly be knowledgeable if there was some rumour going around that, you know, don't be in the vicinity on a certain time.
Well, what this article says is, what can Israel do about the possible coming revelations of its role in the 9/11 attacks? The answer is simple. Israel must flee forward into an ever-widening spiral of global war, because if peace ever breaks out, America's post-9/11 wartime state of emergency will end. Secrecy restrictions will be lifted and 9/11 will be properly investigated. What, you wanted to say something about 9/11
too. Yes, about... I've seen so many programs, so many videos on YouTube about the 9/11 and the way the building fall down and the way the aeroplane went inside, look like is a fake. The towers, they're flattened. They didn't find the black box of the aeroplane, but they found the passport of the terrorists.
Well, that was a bit weird, wasn't it?
Also,
I mean, another thing the article says is that the people they believe who knew about this, these Mossad agents who were over in the United States, failed lie detector tests as well, all three of them. But yet they were just simply sent back to Israel and everything was forgotten about, supposedly. Anyway, so that's another angle. I quite like that theory. I think that may be true, that if a criminal is about to be discovered, what they do is they try and distract everybody, and what better way than through war? Anyway, let's think about also the solutions. Maybe you first, Eddie. What do you think the solution is to what's going on in Gaza now?
Well, for me, a solution would be, and obviously I only speak for myself, would be a one state. They would have to make up what they would call it, with equal rights, you know, that, you know, because this Zionist, you know, kind of aspiration since when, 1917, has caused so much death and destruction. You know, some people even think the Iraqi war itself was on behest of Israel. If that was the case, then there's probably 2 million people that would have been alive today if it wasn't for the aspirations of the Israeli state.
And what about you, Rita? What are your thoughts about the solution?
The solution for Palestine, Israel, drop the weapons, disarm Israel, or maybe just give the equal weapons to the Palestinians and train them. Be equal, live equally in the same country with the Palestinian as president, because that is Palestinian land, and the Israeli, the Jewish people, they stolen the land, and it's the only land when they say God be given to us, is actually, as Ilan Pappe say, Ilan Pappe is an historian, Israeli historian at the university in Exeter, he say 95-98% of the people in Israel, the Jewish people, don't believe in God. So why they say, God give it to me if I don't believe in that person or that God?
It certainly sounds a bit hypocritical, but I thought you might like to hear what Gerald Kaufman was saying last week. He said the one thing which will immediately bring about peace is if the United States pulls its financial support from Israel.
That would be good.
So that would be interesting. Anyway, can you just tell us about your place, your venue, the Palestine Embassy in Broad Street?
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful place where you come in, you feel like you are in Palestine with the good and the bad things. There's a little checkpoint. And there's a little print.
Fingerprints or something?
No, yet. Maybe later if we get more money. if we didn't get funding, then we get a little gadget like that. But at the moment, it's just an artifact of all different topics, including the olive trees. And, of course, we sell the Zaytun product, a beautiful olive oil, almonds, maftour, soap.
Get
embroidery as well.
Get them while there's still olive trees left over there.
Yes, it's very rare. People risk their life to go pick up their olives.
Okay, and Eddie, where would you suggest people go online to follow either what you're doing or both, as well as, you know, the general news from Palestine?
Well, I think any of the major pro-Palestinian groups would do it. I mean, PSC, Palestine Solidarity, which is a new group that's just started in Bristol, and it's vibrant, it has equal Muslim content, so this is not just kind of, you know, white liberals, this is the real people of Bristol Eastern St Paul's.
It's a coalition group though, so it's called Bristol for Palestine, and it's a Facebook group.
Okay, on Facebook. And also you can follow, I know we can follow you on Twitter if we want to, at the Nakba Museum. Now I'll just spell that for you. That's Nakba Museum. That's Nakba Museum, Nakba Museum. So Rita and Eddie, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect this week.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined now by Jason Yannakopoulos for our weekly look around the news. Actually, it's not just Private Eye this week. We're going to be looking around some other stories. And also, we'll take a dip into the world of the persecution of disabled people, I suppose we can call it that these days, yes. By a certain Ian Duncan Smith, In Denial Smith, government minister. But first, Jason, Bilderberg. This is a subject quite close to my heart. How come it's been picked up on your radar?
Well, funnily enough, I was trawling through the web the other day and I found something that I thought might interest you, which I decided to bring it up.
Okay, Bilderberg, let's just get it straight here. Bilderberg is this really very interesting organisation who says it's just a little innocuous think tank where people get together in private, and actually it just turns out it's the people that control most of the money and the media and the oil and the banking in the Western world. So no one needs to take any notice of them. And also, of course, the arms companies too. Bilderberg was set up in the 1950s by a former SS officer, of course, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, and is connected really with many of the wars, for example, the Kosovo War, very connected in with NATO. In fact, many people see it as the real way the Western world's governed, by NATO being the bully boys and Bilderberg being the sort of way that the politicians are bamboozled. I mean, the last Bilderberg conference in Copenhagen this year was a picture of George Osborne, and he was sitting for three quarters of an hour being lectured by the international financial elite about what he was going to do as Chancellor. So I don't get that chance to lobby him, but they do. But anyway, so that's Bilderberg for you. Anyway, how's it come up on your screen?
As I was trawling through it, I found an interesting quote by one of the people you mentioned there, Prince Bernhard from Lippe Biederfeld, I think.
That's right, Lippe Biederfeld. That's right. That was his origin. He was a German aristocracy that married into the Dutch royal family. That's why he was then known as Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. He was also intimately involved in the war in misplanning the liberation of Holland, because he sent an agent in from London, a guy called Christian Lindemans, whose code name was King Kong, in to make contact with the Dutch resistance just before Operation Market Garden, which was the biggest airborne invasion in history, which was the liberation of Holland. The only trouble was this Christian Lindemans, King Kong, wasn't actually on our side. He went straight to the German Abwehr, which is the military intelligence for the Nazis, and gave all of the information he had about the plans for the invasion to them instead. And the Dutch resistance didn't get to hear any of it. So there you go, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Whose side are you really on? Anyway, so what has he been up to?
He came up with a very interesting quote that's, where he said, to accuse us of being interested in the one world government is not wholly untrue.
Not wholly untrue. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, he's saying he wants a one world government. So what are your thoughts about the future for the planet, Jason? If it's not going to be a one world government, what would be good for us all?
Well, I think what would be good for us all is having a collection of states that listen to their people, you know, having governments that are willing to share the, well, share the profit, share the money, share just...
But aren't governments going to be automatically kind of competitive with each other around the world? I mean, like, you know, like the traditionally the British have with, I don't know, the Russians or whatever, the Chinese. I mean, they're bound to be sort of competing, aren't they?
Unfortunately, that is a natural side effect, not that it's necessary or indeed helpful.
And what do you think of the role of the UN since World War II? Because it was all blasted at the time. Everyone said, this is going to be great. You know, everyone is actually going to go through the UN, so there won't be any more wars. But, of course, there have been. Is there anything you'd like to see to sort of help reform the UN and make it more effective?
Well, I'd like to see, countries actually listen to the UN. You know, the United Nations was made in the best of intentions. For all the countries in the world, and it's just a shame that no one seems to listen to it anymore.
Well, that's, yeah, a lot of it is, I think, probably because they don't really have the force of arms. I mean, you've got this situation, haven't you? You've got your two main parts of the UN, well, you've got lots of others, but the two main bits are the Security Council, which is the military, and the big powers. You've got the permanent members of the Security Council. And then you've got the General Assembly, which is all the countries. Now, it seems like something's a little bit wrong here in that the military is independent of the General Assembly, so they do what they want, and the General Assembly can't tell them what to do. So it seems that the military are actually more important in the UN than the ambassadors from all the individual countries.
And that's worrying. I mean, that's very worrying. We're looking at this, we're looking at a situation now where basically the whole world is controlled by the very powerful nations, just like it's always been.
Well, yes.
Yeah, so imperialism on a wide scale still exists.
Okay, well, so something needs to change, doesn't it? And I mean, it seems to me that just simply telling the Security Council, you're going to have to do what the General Assembly of the United Nations say, that is, that all of the people of the world, rather than just the most powerful ones, where a lot of the arms wealth is concentrated in the in those countries. And it also, everything to do with the Middle East, we know this as a fact, the Americans veto everything. So if there's any going to be any kind of challenge at the UN to what the Israelis are up to, it gets vetoed by the United States and often Britain too, of course. Anyway, OK, on to something a little bit closer to home from the UN, and that's Baroness Varsi. She's got a little bit involved with what's been going on in Gaza with the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Yes, she resigned on Tuesday, citing that she could no longer back the government policy on Gaza.
And why do you think she's done that?
Well, she obviously feels strongly as a Muslim woman about the fact that there are a lot of quite innocent Muslim people being butchered in Gaza by rocket and the Israeli military.
Okay, so, I mean, she's Muslim herself. And the other thing, I mean, in a way, it ties in nicely with what we were talking about the UN, because she is the minister with responsibility for the UN.
Yes, Minister of Faith and World Culture and the UN.
Amazing, isn't it, really? So this is quite a big move. Do you think she's maybe angling to take over the Conservative Party from Cameron? Do you think she'll succeed? Or
well, that'd be refreshing, wouldn't it?
Interesting to see, certainly.
I don't think she's white, male, or posh enough.
Well, we'll see. Anyway, I think you might be right there, Jason. Also, staying on the subject of war, it's the anniversary, isn't it, of the Britain entering the First World War. Always, I think, on these occasions, I like to mention the poet Geoffrey Studdart Kennedy, who is my favourite World War One poet, because he's obviously somebody who was well loved by the soldiers themselves. Although he doesn't appear in any of the Penguin guides you'll find in the bookshops. If you want to get a book of poetry on the high street about World War II, you won't find Geoffrey Studdart Kennedy. He was known better as Woodbine Willie. And so I always like to mention him as a brilliant poet. I remember my grandfather fought in the First World War, and he was saying, oh, there's no other poets worth reading. Woodbine Willie's your boy. And so I would just advise listeners to check out Woodbine Willie. Also, to let you know that up in Worcester Cathedral, for the next few weeks, there is an exhibition of Woodbine Willie in I think it's actually, is it Worcester Cathedral? Yes, it's Worcester Cathedral, isn't it? And one of the pastors there, because Worcester was where he was originally from, although he spent obviously many, many months in the trenches he was an army chaplain, sort of tending to the horrific situation there was there. He was originally from Worcester. So there's an exhibition up in Worcester Cathedral about Woodbine Willie at the moment. And what frustrates me is when you're going to bring out a collection of First World War poetry, don't miss him out. Don't miss out Woodbine Willie. Of course, the soldiers loved him. They called him that because he used to go around with the Woodbine cigarettes dishing out fags for people.
So why do you think he's been missed out, Tony?
Well, maybe because he was telling the truth. And actually, he probably is the best poet of the First World War. Never mind all the people we're told about at school, you've got to have this one, that one. But Woodbine Willie's your boy. And I totally trust my granddad because he actually worked in the Royal Army Medical Corps in World War One, taking soldiers out from the front line and actually risked his life as well. But he was basically a pacifist. He didn't want to fight. He thought the whole thing was a low waste of time. And I think he was right. There's just a few people like Prince William and others from the royal family that seemed to think that there was some kind of point to it all. What more do you have for us on the First World War, Jason?
Well, of course, there's a lot of people there. A lot of commentary on the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge laying wreaths. And speaking of poetry, which kind of ties in nicely, there was a poem read out by Prince Harry. Well, actually, no, it wasn't a poem, sorry, it was a letter. It was a lost letter from the soldier, and it's all about, oh, look at the royals, aren't they great?
Yeah, but the royals started it all.
Well, yes.
They started the war.
There's a point to make, people saying that we were fighting against, fighting against oppression and all that. It was actually the First World War was two empires colliding with each other. In fact, more than two empires. It was a few empires colliding with each other.
Can you just remind us? Because it was a war of cousins, wasn't it? Three cousins.
Three cousins who are absolutely similar. And, of course, I think we brought this this point up at Christmas, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
About
But on the week that Britain entered the war, it's a good idea to remind ourselves and everyone else.
I was given a quiz sheet with the pictures of George V of England, the Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany, and Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, and asked to identify which one's which, and I actually managed to get it wrong because they looked so much like each other. It was scary.
Yeah, so it was basically a family quarrel, not a Windsor family quarrel, no, a Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family quarrel that went got out of hand. So yes. I think actually Prince William and anybody else, including Michael Gove, that wants to say there was some point to that mindless slaughter, needs a bit of a slap about the face, I think, a gentle one, in order to bring them back to sanity.
Certainly, I'll agree with you on that.
Thank you, Jason. Oh, okay. Any other thoughts from you about cultural stuff from the First World War? Good TV series, books, that sort of thing that's worth looking up?
I don't know. I'm not really a war person myself. Actually, funnily enough, my grandfather didn't fight in the First World War. His judge that his eyesight wasn't good enough.
Well, lucky him. That's probably good for him, wasn't it? Yeah. Anyway, also looking at the disabled, and I suppose in a way that's connected with war, because a lot of disabled people have also been injured from one reason or another. The number of people in work claiming housing benefits soars, we hear, this week, which is also affecting, obviously, many disabled people. Number of working people who rely on housing benefit to boost their incomes doubled in 5 years. Doubled at the cost of billions of pounds to the taxpayer. Labour will seize on the figures to argue that the millions more people are trapped in insecure jobs and poverty pay despite so-called evidence of economic growth. And there's House of Commons statistics which are saying that 478,000 people with jobs claimed housing benefit, rising to an expected 962,000 this year. Unbelievable amounts. And if you've got a job, you're still having to claim housing benefit. So where is all this money going? Anyway, what's your thoughts on this, Jason? Because the Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary, Rachel Reeves, is blaming those increases on the government's inability to tackle low pay. I mean, that's what the Labour Party's saying about it.
Well, yes, this is the problem, isn't it? They say that the economy is improving, that the economy is going up, it's getting better, it will boom soon. The problem is that the wages are not going up. I mean, the wage bill is the one thing that isn't going up. Whereas everything else is going up, which means that...
this means... I'll tell you what it means, I think. Quantitative easing. that there's all this money appearing. All this money is appearing in the stock exchange, but it's not finding its way into the real world. All this money is appearing in the derivatives markets and all these casino gambling. Hang on a minute. Didn't the Andrew Tyrie's committee decide that we weren't going to do that anymore?
Well, you know how successful they've been in attempts on stopping that in the past.
Okay. Anyway, Jason, thanks very much for taking us through the news this week, Jason.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
What's on, Jeff Sparks?
Thank you, Tony. This is your What's On guy from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 8th of August, the Rupees will be performing with support from Beat Harlow's, Painted Faces and also Tonic for Tigers at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Moving into Saturday, 9th of August, the Thin Lizzy Tribute Act, Limehouse Lizzy, will be performing with support at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £12.50 in advance and doors open at 7pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Screamin' Jay Hawkins. He was an American rhythm and blues musician and singer, and in a career that spanned around 40 years, he released 14 studio albums, 6 live albums and numerous singles. This song, I Put a Spell on You, has been included in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 500 Songs That Shaped Rock and Roll.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Stop the things you do.
Watch out!
I ain't lying.
Ah, I can't stand. Woo!
No running around. I can't stand. I can't stand no putting me down. Spell on you.
Screamin' Jay Hawkins with I Put a Spell on You, a song that has been covered by many musicians, namely Nina Simone, Brian Ferry and also Joe Cocker. Finally, into Monday, 11th of August, the Old Firm Casuals, who featured Lars Fredriksson of Rancid, will be performing with support from Control and also Running Riot at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download this podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests, Rita Kangalusi and Eddie James from the Palestine University, an embassy even in Broad Street in Bristol. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Webster Tartley, I'm afraid we'll have to wait till next week. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect and I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.